Hello, everybody. Welcome to Health Chatter. Today's show will be on autism, which one way or the other is a hot topic in today's world. And we'll be talking a lot about it with a wonderful guest. I'll introduce her in a moment. We've got a wonderful crew, which I always like to recognize. Maddie Levine Wolf, who actually did the background research for this show, that all our listening audience can tune into on our website, which I'll tell you in a second. So Maddie Levine Wolf, Aaron Collins, Deandra Howard, Matthew Campbell, Sheridan Nygaard are all second to none. They've been with us since day one and have really, really helped us make this show successful on many, many fronts. So thank you guys. You're super duper. Barry Baines is our medical advisor and gives us a little bit of a medical twist. For those of us who have public health backgrounds, he provides the medical twist background. And then there's my dear colleague, Clarence Jones. We've been doing this since day one, having a lot of fun, meeting a lot of people, discussing a lot of things, and hopefully providing useful information for you, the listening audience. So thank you, Clarence, as well. Human Partnership is our sponsor. You great community health organization doing wonderful, wonderful things out in the community related to health. You should check them out at humanpartnershipalliance.org. And you can check us out at healthchatterpodcast.com for all of our shows that we've done since day one. So thanks for everybody being here. So today, autism. We have a wonderful guest with us. Ellie Wilson is the executive director of the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm sure that she is connected with her colleagues in other states as well. We can talk about that. She's been working to support children, teens, adults with autism spectrum disorders for 20 years. Wow, you're going to have to tell us about how you got involved in this. Has done really, really wonderful things, and you'll be able to see it all on our website. Her specialty is fostering energized, healthy community partnerships to promote the evolution of our inclusive societal landscape for individuals on the spectrum. And we'll talk about that word, too. Or with other disabilities. So it's really wonderful having you. And thank you so much for being on Health Chatter. So, all right, I'll kick it off. And God knows where it'll go from here, but we've got a lot to talk about. Okay.
We do.
So first of all, let's make sure, since autism has kind of hit the scene lately, certainly, it's out there. Let's start out with getting your true definition on what autism is.
Great. Great place to start, as there is much to cover. So let's get the ground rules. All right. An autism spectrum diagnosis is something that we call a neurodevelopmental disability. And if you break those words down, neuro means something that affects your brain, and developmental implies that this disorder is something that happens from the time you are born and affects the way your brain develops over time. A neurodevelopmental disability. There are several components of the autism diagnosis. And the ones that I think people are most familiar with are that autistic people tend to have differences in how they communicate, how they sort of process information, particularly social and sensory information. And also, autistic people have a tendency to require or benefit from a lot of repetition and routine in their life in one form or another, whether that's an observable behavior that they do over and over again, or sort of a rigidity in how they like to sort of go through their days, weeks, months. Those are the basics of what is an autism diagnosis. Most autism diagnoses are made by the time someone is about 5 years old. That's no coincidence that that's about the same time that children enter school. But Frankly, autism can be diagnosed at any age. And oftentimes we do see some folks not necessarily get diagnosed until they're teenagers, young adults, or older adults. But the point is, if you are assessed for autism, you have to be able to attest to the fact that the way you communicate and process information has been so since you were a young child. If it's something that onsets in your teenage years or young adult years, it's not autism.
Interesting. So, in other words, you can't develop autism,
That's right.
but you're
Not
more or less
only,
born with it, correct?
yep, totally. You can't develop it in the middle of life, and you also can't grow out of it. That's another big misconception, is that autism is something that affects someone throughout their entire life. It's not something that goes away once you become an adult. And, I think there can certainly be autistic people that learn all kinds of great strategies and access resources they need to sort of manage their disability over time. There are certainly many cases of autism where you might not know from looking at somebody. We're going to talk about the spectrum shortly, and that spectrum is really wide. So there are all kinds of sort of assumptions baked in and stereotypes to address, but the point is, you have it from the time you're born, and you have it until you die.
So, is it defined as a medical issue?
It is included in what we call the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So, someone who is trained in psychiatry in medicine is qualified to diagnose autism alongside any number of other developmental disorders, intellectual disabilities, mental health conditions. It's all under the purview of that DSM, which is the guidebook that helps people make those diagnoses.
And you have it, you start getting it, or you have it at a younger age, and then you learn how to cope with autism. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, people learn to cope in different ways at different ages. And of course, new stressors or circumstances can be introduced to an autistic person's life at any time. So I don't mean to imply that the trajectory is linear. What I mean to say is that the ways in which an autistic person presents can be quite obvious and earn a diagnosis at a very young age. Sometimes the presentation of autism can be obscured not only by a person's individual profile of skills, but frankly by a number of biases that I would love to talk to you about, as a matter of fact.
Clarence, hit it.
I thank you. I'm really glad that we're having this conversation. In certain parts of our community, there are people that are very upset about autism, and they think it came from vaccinations. But what you just said is that a person is born with it. And could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I again, as I said, there's been a lot of conversation in our community about, it's only because of the vaccination that we have that their children have autism.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about cause for a minute to the greatest extent we can. And we want to be really responsible about knowing the limitations of this part of the conversation. But many, many people, especially because the prevalence of autism continues to sort of grow and therefore present a public health phenomenon, I think there are many, many people on a societal and on an individual basis that are hungry to know why does autism happen. And there are things that we actually do understand about this. Let's start at the basics, which is even though autism is technically a medical diagnosis and something that certainly can be diagnosed by a medical provider, it's different from many other disabilities because there is no like single gene or characteristic, let's say, in your blood that we can test for. Many other disability profiles have, sort of crystal clear biological evidence where we can say, yes, we've confirmed that you have this genetic difference or this, characteristic of your profile that earns you a diagnosis. In autism, we're really looking at people's behavior. And behavior, of course, is a lot more complex of a thing to measure. That being said, we do know, we are certain that autism does have a hereditary component. And we can study the heritability of autism without necessarily being able to single out one specific autism gene. We are quite certain that there is no one autism gene. But what we do see are very clear patterns of autism and other neurodiversities, let's call them, across generations of families. And we also know for certain that if you have one autistic child, there's some likelihood that you have another autistic or otherwise neurodivergent child. So we do believe there are genetic components. And that's part of why we understand that autism is part of your life from the time you're born, because you already got those genes inside you by the time you're born.
Okay.
Now, others are looking at things like vaccines. And here's what's really interesting about vaccines. Much of the sort of child vaccine schedule, right, the cadence at which children are given routine vaccines in order to prevent communicable illness. They are scattered throughout a time in a child's development when there also are a lot of other important milestones happening, whether that's the first time a child, speaks, whether it's the time that they start to show signs of other types of social interactions. And, there's some pretty obvious confusion that happens around the time where parents and even misinformed members of the sort of general provider landscape are misattributing those behavioral differences to a time that someone is vaccinated. And guys, the theory has been disproved about 1,000 times. And so at the end of the day, we don't reject the curiosity. We understand that people really want to know and want to investigate, but we also are beating a dead horse when it comes to the issue of vaccination
Good
specifically.
point. Good point.
Yeah,
So
thanks.
here, I've got a couple things. I'm kind of checking in on a little bit of our background here, but let me preface it by saying this was interesting. About oh God, maybe it was 6 months or so ago. I was watching the show Survivor. Okay, I don't know if this rings a bell with you,
Of
Ellie,
course, I know what you're going to
but there
say.
was a contestant on there, a young woman. And actually, she's from Minnesota. Maybe you even know her.
I
But
do.
okay. Anyway, so and she was, I she identified. She let people know that she was autistic, and throughout the show, you could see some of those manifestations coming to light. And it was I really appreciated her. I really, really did, because she helped to put a face to it, that people live with it and know how to survive with it. So that was pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hi, at least.
You are referring to Eva Erickson, who ended up
Yes.
being the runner-up finalist of the show. She almost took the whole thing.
Exactly.
She is a woman in her mid-20s, originally from Minnesota. She was diagnosed when she was only 2 years old, at a provider in our local landscape that we know very well. Eva is an amazing intellect. I don't know if you know that she's actually a PhD candidate at Brown,
Yes,
right now.
I saw that.
But she's also an incredible athlete. She defies a number of important stereotypes around the sort of autistic perspective, which we love. But above all, what happened on Survivor is that Eva not only disclosed her disability to the show, but she managed to use disclosure as a way to gain herself some allyship in the show in a way that really represents a cool story of someone advocating for themselves, teaching someone else about what their needs are, especially in a high stress situation. And that young woman, effectively really not only managed her disability internally, but she managed the resources around her to be able to access support when she needs it. And she spoke about it beautifully and eloquently in a way that I do think rocked the sort of survivor fan landscape, which was pretty
Yeah,
cool to see.
I thought it was really remarkable, really.
Yeah.
And it was a voice to the to autism. So all right, so let me, you kind of alluded to this a little bit. So our researcher Maddie put together that 70 to 90% of children with autism have some co-occurring mental health diagnosis or an intellectual disability. Some even have epilepsy.
That's right.
So it appears as though there isn't a norm, so to speak, for autism.
Yeah. So this is part of when we say the spectrum is really wide, right? This is part of what contributes to that huge diversity of presentation of autism is how it tends to co-occur with other types of disabilities. You named all the ones that are important, but let's just pick them apart for a second. About a third of autistic people also qualify for what's called an intellectual disability. Intellectual disability is essentially a function of how someone performs on an IQ test, perhaps in another episode or over a couple of beers. I'd happily tell you what the complications are with that issue. But let's say about a third of people have a co-occurring intellectual disability. That means two-thirds don't, for what it's worth. Now, you also mentioned epilepsy. About a third of autistic people, though not necessarily the same third as those with ID, also have a history of seizures or epilepsy that also affects sort of their various health outcomes and their needs. But certainly, the one that you mentioned first, I think, is the most important. What we understand more and more as years go on about autistic people is that, especially as they age, become teenagers, young, and older adults, we know that they have a very high prevalence of anxiety, depression, and a couple of other key disorders. The other big one is ADHD. ADHD and autism can occur together. That's something that medical providers didn't used to understand. They used to think you kind of had to be one or the other. And in fact, you can have both. And so, this is just the first layer of the onion, but this is part of why we see so much difference between autistic people. It's part of what explains the phenomenon of like, I know two autistic people, but they're totally different from each other. Why do they have the same label? This co-occurring disability, is part of that diversity.
So Barry, I'm going to pull you in just a sec. I've got one link question here. What happens, and how do you identify or deal with teens, adults that have what I would consider to be late onset types of situations that you commonly see in autism? What do you call those people? I mean, are they? They just have certain mental health disorders. In other words, is it, like you said before, it can't be late onset. You have it or you don't. But later on, if you embrace some of the things like we just talked about, how do you make the distinction then?
Sorry, I thought that question was for Barry.
Oh, no, that's for
Okay,
you.
got you. So, I'm sorry about that. So, part of what you, I think, are identifying, it has to do with things most akin to things like anxiety and depression. I mean, there are certainly some of us that might be more prone to anxiety or might experience stronger levels of anxiety throughout our lives, surely. But in the same way, we can conceptualize that, teenagers, young adults, and older adults might have anxiety and depression issues than they didn't necessarily have when they were children. That's where we can see those things start to layer in. Though it's certainly not a disorder, it's also worth mentioning puberty. Like the presence of puberty, the experience of puberty is also something that tends to create some really important shifts for autistic people and for everyone, of course. But the idea is there aren't just circumstantial, but there are also mental health or developmental health things that sort of happen to someone in their trajectory that
Gotcha.
can either complicate their autism or affect it in some way.
Yeah, and I I will
Great.
weigh in a little bit here to kind of in partnership with Ellie. One of the things that's most interesting to me is number one, the vast majority of people have excellent executive function. They function very well. They have their routines, and it works well. And Stan, it's more that the comorbidities of things like anxiety, depression, ADHD, those kind of things can effectively unmask, as it were, or the unlayering someone that maybe didn't carry that label of being autistic, but because of this comorbidity, it upset a lot of their routines and things that they either had under excellent control. And I mean, like I said, like just about everybody has behaviors that are strange, in a way. I mean, that's part of being human. And so especially later in adolescence, of course, again, is another stressful thing, not to mention all the hormonal changes that people go through. And these things can kind of unmask someone who either function very well, or they may have been aware, but also there are people that try to hide that they have autism. And again, it's sort of that unmasking effect of these mental health issues. The other quick 2 points I wanted to make is there's not a medication to give somebody to make their autism better, okay? And yet their comorbidities can be more effectively managed, right? Whether it's ADHD, depression, anxiety, those things, again, our last show, Ellie, was on medication management. So we were saying, well, should we just medicate? But the thing is, what's important is that if people have those comorbidities and they are on some medication, that doesn't mean you're not treating their autism, but in the broader picture. The other piece, I just talked with colleagues of mine. I'm a family physician by training. I talked to some of my family physician friends. I talked to three of my pediatric colleagues with autism. I said, well, what do you do, for autism, or where can I find a resource to get on Health Chatter, especially with all the stuff that's going on the public health sphere. And this is extremely perplexing for general pediatricians, for general family physicians, practitioners, generalists, because it is difficult to diagnose, and the level of comorbidities. And then the last piece, and then I'll be quiet for a while. I love the spectrum diagram that we have, and I know that that'll be posted, on Health Chatter. But the thing is, when you think about a spectrum of a disease like diabetes, okay, usually you can measure that by your A1C and, your heart disease. So it is more linear in a way that can be measured. So it's more like I think of it as up and down, whereas with the spectrum for autism is very horizontal. It's like the pool. Or you throw the rock in the pool and the ripples, go out, and it has different levels of findings, of behaviors. And then the last piece is that oftentimes, and this, Ellie, is where I, thank you for all that you do, but the idea of setting up all of these supportive services that really can help people with autism to manage behaviors better so that they are able to remain and become very functional people in society. One of the people I always think of is Temple Grandin, who's very well known. And she actually, I took a course on how to teach diverse learners at the U in mathematics. I like to help kids with math. And one of her papers that we studied was about how, a good approach to people who are on the autism spectrum to find a way that helps to teach them more effectively. And she also is the person that has done a lot of things with animal behavior, if anybody has, read about that. But anyway, those are the, some of the points I just wanted to make, and then
Yeah.
I'll throw it back, throw my hat back in the
Clarence.
ring, and let the crew here and Ellie, kind of either respond or
Clarence, take it
I'm
away.
not the expert on this, but all this makes me think a lot about it, so.
Yeah. Hey, Barry, thanks for that. Ellie, I want to know what percentage of children are born with autism?
Okay, good question. So the most recent numbers, which this is technically the CDC that keeps track of prevalence of autism across the United States, and the CDC is actually comprised of usually somewhere between 10 and 15 university centers from around the country who actually do the work. It just so happens one of those centers is in Minnesota. So we're lucky enough to have some state data and some national data. But as of the most recent study, what they've reported is that one in 31 children who are about 8 years old for the purpose of the study across the United States could qualify for an autism diagnosis. Minnesota's numbers were pretty close to that. Our numbers here are one in 28.
Wow. So Clarence, you're the community person here. Ellie, based on what the Autism Society of Minnesota does, I think there's some linkages here between how to effectively use community in order to help people with autism. So, Clarence.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's interesting, and again, I so much appreciate this conversation because it is a conversation for me that I kind of hear about.
Yeah.
I know that there are certain, as I was in alluding a little bit earlier, there are certain communities where this is a real major piece, and but what can we do? I mean. You said one in 28 here in Minnesota. What is it that we should be doing, or how should we be familiarizing our communities about this issue? Because I think a lot of times when people come across this particular issue or behavior in a person, they just think that it's a, I'll use this term, it's just a bad child. A disobedient child, you know what I mean? And so, we don't necessarily understand that. How could we be communicating this so that parents who might be experiencing these types of behavior might seek additional support?
Absolutely. What a great question, Clarence. I think there are so many responses that I would like to promote, but let's start with that sort of individual and family unit because that is sometimes where the magic really happens, of course. I think first things first, sort of awareness and acceptance campaigns are really important because so many people still do misunderstand the nature of autism. Of course, if we were to compare it to another sort of well-known disability like Down syndrome, there is something you can see in a person with Downs. And when you look at an autistic person, you don't always know by looking at them that they are autistic. And that combined with the fact that we are studying people's behavior generally means that there's just lots of room for misunderstanding, for bias, or for misinformation. And so I do think we have a deep responsibility to not just be out here saying facts about autism, but to have meaningful connections with facets of the community that sort of have their own challenges unique to autism and disability. You might know that one part of the prevalent story here in Minnesota is that we experience the richness of a large Somali community. And even though autism is something that really does occur relatively consistently across all racial and ethnic groups, we are starting to be able to prove that the prevalence in the Somali community is almost twice as high as what it is in the rest of the community. So that means that when we think about community engagement, we're not just thinking about it broadly, we're thinking about what are some of those unique intersections where we can show up and do the extra work of understanding not only how does this manifest in a particular community, but what are the attitudes about it? What are the sources of that misinformation? What are the strengths we can leverage about various communities in order to get this done in a meaningful way? Because the misinformation around autism does seem to be our greatest dragon to slay, if you will. Like, it is what always haunts us.
You know, it's interesting that you're saying that. I'm a fatherhood doula. And so I know a lot of things around infants and things of that nature. And I'm thinking that, and again, I'm going to be a cultural area. You know, a lot of time people think that, you know, when a child acts up, it's a reflection on them, the family.
Totally.
You know what I mean? And so that's why I use the term a bad child. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I'm wondering again about the importance of having this information available for parenting groups
yeah.
to deal with. And I haven't seen anything about that. And so perhaps you can help me with that in terms of presenting that information. Because
yeah.
I think what you're saying right now, 1 in 28 here in Minnesota, and I know how behavior is one of the factors that families really, you know, they really are looking at for their children, how this might be important information for them.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is stigma, you know, like there is stigma associated with behavioral health disorders, in part because sometimes people do misattribute them to how you're raised or how you discipline your kids. You know, these concepts are highly cultural. And so if we engage with them with the express purpose of being culturally responsive when we do it, we tend to be a lot more effective in being able to dismantle some of those ideas. In our space, the word we use for this is neurodiversity affirming, right? So if the opposite of stigma is affirmation, what we try to do is still center resources that are factual. You know, like it's not about spinning a narrative. It's about helping families and specifically parents understand that, first of all, they did not cause their child's autism, that they can and should be allowed to look at their child as a profile of, yes, needs and challenges, but also strengths and gifts, and that their child's needs matter, and that there are ways in which parents can access supports for those needs in a way that doesn't require them to talk about their child like a tragedy.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You know, for those of us who are trained in public health, communication is really key. So it's kind of like we're in this damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's like all of a sudden, you know, autism is out there. You know, it's kind of communication-wise, frankly, in a negative way. On the other hand, it brings the attention to it. So there is some positive to that, so that people can get, hopefully through like shows like this and through information exchange, they can get the honest information and correct information. Unfortunately, that might have been dubbed from, you know, from the incorrect information that came out. But sometimes there's a silver lining in this. So I want to make sure, Ellie, that you address the autism spectrum. And for those on the show, you know, there's a diagram that we'll have in the research that you can refer to. But in the meantime, go ahead. Why don't you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So let's have a little language lesson. There's some language that we can use here. First of all, you probably have heard the words before. Someone has high functioning autism or someone has low functioning autism. If I may, respectfully, I'd like to suggest that we move away from that binary. Barry before was talking about sort of like the horizontal nature of the spectrum or the ripple effect of the spectrum. And that is probably a lot more accurate and frankly affirming way to talk about autism amongst autistic people at the very
I
least.
Agree.
And you know, what are we so surprised by? Anytime you try to narrow people down into either one of two options, like, yeah, it doesn't work very well for most people. There's something about autistic development that's really interesting. I'll only mention it briefly because, of course, like this could be its own topic, but there's something called splintered skill development that happens amongst autistic children and adults. And that is that the way an autistic brain tends to develop is that rather than having a bunch of centers of your brain sort of develop in a way that's quite cohesive, we see development in autistic children where they develop some skills very quickly and effectively to the point where, you know, you might see an autistic person that has a profound skill in a certain area, whether that's, you know, a language asset that they have, or whether it's a particular affinity for a certain topic, math or science, or you know, animal studies, like you mentioned with Temple Grandin. There is this sort of profound likelihood of developing great skills, but there are also real ways in which that lack of cohesion of that brain development means that you have unexpected challenges or differences that really need a lot of support. And so rather than someone necessarily being like all strengths or all weaknesses, what we see is this dispersal of skills all over the map that makes it, by definition, incredibly difficult to characterize someone as high or low functioning. If you need those words, think of saying something like, ah, this person has a lot of support needs, they have very high support needs. Or you could say this person has very low support needs. But in general, let's take some responsibility for rejecting the idea that someone fits into one of two categories. Because here's what happens, you guys. What happens is someone says, oh, please meet my son, Bobby. He's autistic, but don't worry, he's high functioning. And when someone says something like that, it means we're kind of inclined to ignore the ways in which they really need help, whether that's well masked or not. You know, this is part of how autistic people tend to get into a lot of trouble at school or at their jobs, or even occasionally, you know, amongst emergency responders like police officers. The idea is that, yeah, a person might be able to speak and have great talents and engage well, but they have certain areas where they need a lot of help. And when we call them high functioning, we tend to ignore that that is the reality. And
It
on the
also
other hand, calling
begs the
someone low
question too.
functioning is a jerk move. I would never call someone low functioning to their face or otherwise. And I think that we should move away from that language out of respect for a lot of autistic people who may not speak, for instance, or may not have a full-time job, or may have high support needs, but still have more to contribute to their families or communities than most people expect.
You know, it's interesting. If somebody says, "Oh, my child, is high functioning," it begs the question, "Well, what's low functioning then?"
That's right. That's right.
It's like, why go there?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't do anybody any good. So I highly agree with you on that.
But you know what I think, Stan? I think when a person has to affirm that or say that says something about them too. They want
I agree.
they want to show that their child has some value, that there's some
Right.
conflict that's there, and so they want people to accept that child as quote unquote normal, or just that, well, we have some difficulties, but he's really he or she is really a great child. And I think that's part of the challenge in terms of this particular issue is that we know so little about it, and we look so much at the behavior as kind of like as the final piece of how we're going to evaluate that child. And so families want to protect that child. And so I
Yes.
can understand that very few people would say, well, my child is low functioning.
Yeah, I mean, but
Yeah,
yeah.
because that's a that appears to them to be a reflection on them,
Yeah,
right?
right,
So I
yeah.
mean, so this conversation to me is so important to have so that people can really understand and become more comfortable with talking about this.
Yeah, and Clarence, this is your point is so well made and so astute, and sort of circles us back to the previous point we were talking about with stigma, which is like, where does that emotional drive come with families to sort of defend their kid or, to sort of insist that they need help? That usually is sort of a response to the social landscape of autism rather than the medical landscape of
Yeah.
autism, and it's a clear indicator that that's where most of our work has to be done.
It's one thing if the child has to own it, and then it's another thing if the parents have to own it too, and they own it perhaps at different levels that we that aren't dealing with autism in our families, we should be sensitive to and try our best to really understand. I'll tell you, this is an incredible information. Barry, go ahead.
Yeah. So I want to make a an analogy between asthma and autism, not because they both begin with the letter A, but in asthma management, there's a very well-developed plan of action to help individuals manage their asthma. Now this tends to be mostly medication-oriented, depending on asthma symptoms. But what I'm wondering about is within the neurodevelopmental field, do they have sort of plans that I'm just going to call them an autism support plan that obviously you need the input of family and the person themselves that know what things to do or not to do, things that help them and things that don't help them, for bringing that. In the same way that people in school, they develop this IEP or individual education
Yeah.
plan, that kind of thing. I'm just wondering if there's something like that that already exists or is in the works, because having something like that can be both educational for the people around someone with autism and families with autism, but also help people to perform as best they can, and to sort of avoid things that exacerbate,
Yeah, yeah.
things. So I was
No,
just
that's a
kind
good
of thinking
point.
about that, and is there something analogous within the autism support services that can kind of educate us?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there's one framework for that. As intriguing as an idea as it is, I think what ends up happening, and you sort of alluded to it, is that those plans become specific to a certain environment. So, like, there's a clear process of how you are supposed to put one of those plans together in a public school setting. That's the individualized education plan that you talked about. There are certainly plans that people can make that have to do with their job and where they work, what kind of supports they need, what kind of accommodations they can get, what kind of disclosure they need to make to their boss or their colleagues so that they are better understood. There are certainly plans that certain types of therapists make with an autistic person in their family where they, again, might sort of be learning to better understand their own needs and how to advocate for those needs in different settings. But there is no sort of universal plan that people make. I think that's part of the work a group like the Autism Society does, is we try to empower autistic people and their families with the type of information that really does help them understand themselves, and start to put together those advocacy strategies, those self-advocacy strategies. And those might be unique to one relationship, or they might be unique to a setting like a school or a job, for instance.
You exude such confidence around this subject matter, and I'm sure it's because of your years in dealing with it. But it also provides us with a level of confidence that I can speak for myself that I greatly appreciate, because knowing that there are really good organizations and professionals out there that know about this, that truly know about it. And I underscore that word. I think is absolutely wonderful. What I'd like to do, Clarence unfortunately had to sign off, but we always do some last words here. And I'm sure I'll speak for him and myself here, where this is a community thing. It really is. I mean, we really care about people that suffer from autism. We need to embrace them and work with them and realize, hey, come on, we'll hold hands together as we go through life and all the tribulations. And I'm sure that Clarence would echo that. Barry, last thoughts.
Well, number one, I'm just so glad that I listened to the NPR show that when you and Zephyr were on an interview a couple of months ago, and just to get connected because I'm like I, my head was
Great.
exploding because I was trying to find someone to come on the show as a guest expert on autism, and after I heard that, I said, you're the one.
You're the
And
one.
that was
Hey,
great. And then
I'm grateful.
and the conversation here, it's really been amazing, to me. And I continue to learn, so much, about the different topics that we have. The point I want to make is that what's really too bad, and I'm hoping that opportunities are disguised as problems. But basically, the inaccuracies that unfortunately formerly highly trusted government agencies have come out with things that are, the medical term is like nonsense, and just, cherry picking and picking little things that don't make any sense scientifically. What I'm hoping is that, sometimes if you shine a spotlight on something, it might offer an opportunity for better community education,
Right.
and to be able to sort of, move on from that. But, again, I know opportunities are disguised as problems. It would be better to not have to deal with those problems on top of everything else that, that we need to deal with. And so, I'll just end by saying, thank you so much, and thank you for what you do with the Autism Society of Minnesota. And, Stan, I want to put a plug in that I think this is a topic that we should probably explore to have another
I
episode
agree.
down the
I
road, because
agree.
there's a lot here, and it's impossible to unpack it all in, in one 45-minute episode. And that said, Ellie, I think you did a great job of setting the table for us for those kind of things. So again, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to having you on the show again at some point in the future. It would be great.
I would really love that. Thank you, Barry, and thank you, Stan, and thank you to Clarence. If I could have two final thoughts, it would probably be in response to what you said. The first is that autism and disability broadly, even, really are not partisan issues, right?
Thank you.
People find themselves with disability from the time they're born or onset for any number of reasons. Frankly, if you make it to a certain age, you're going to make it into the category of folks who are disabled in this country. The othering of disabled or autistic people is really not helpful. And there are certainly, let's just say, autism knows no allegiance to red or blue. Like we really, our community extends across every facet of diversity that it could. And there's a difference between something being partisan and something being politicized. And I do fear that
Thank you.
autism has been deeply politicized, in a way that has horrible consequences, not just for, individuals and families, but in our population. The Minnesota autism community is diverse, and when subjected to so much misinformation and rhetoric, stands to be divided It creates division for us in a way that is deeply unhelpful and antithetical to the
That's right.
advocacy that we need in order to really achieve something. Because I'll tell you, we know what to achieve. This is not some huge head-scratching mystery where we go, like, what are we going to do? There is wisdom amongst the community here, in large part led by autistic people and families, and also amongst those who have committed their careers to doing this. There are absolutely solutions at our fingertips, and all we have to do is work together and get out of our own dang way in order to be able to achieve that. And if I could make one more point, it would, especially to Clarence, would be to say, the beauty of public health is about how we can interpret it across a number of really important public sectors. You want to talk the importance of public education and how to think about autism in education? Let's spend an episode doing that. You want to talk about autism and healthcare? Wow, let's talk about what it means for autistic people to access not just preventive, but responsive healthcare that really supports them, regardless of their needs. Let's talk about public safety. Let's talk about how autistic people are 7 to 12 times more likely to interact with emergency responders than their neurotypical counterparts, and therefore how important it is to know that EMS, fire, and police officers know how to support an autistic person across an array of different circumstances. Let's talk about employment. There, every space that contributes to not just the life, but the quality of life of any particular person is where this advocacy can and should live. And that's the kind of range that an organization like the Autism Society of Minnesota continues to take responsibility to have. It's why we show up in all of these different spaces. We are a small but mighty organization that knows that we have some really important points to be made across every single one of those sectors. And I look forward to continue to advocate, especially with new friends like Health
Well,
Chatter.
thank you. This has been great. To all of you out there that are listening to Health Chatter today, and who you might be autistic or, for that matter, connected to somebody that is, we in the Health Chatter community embrace you. All right, we're here to support you. We're here to provide as much conversation around honest and accurate conversation around autism as we possibly can. And we invite you, Ellie, back. We invite you with perhaps, some people that are suffering from autism and are dealing with it, to be on our show. So thank you. Thank you so much for your insights. It's been really enlightening. So
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Of course, the greatest suffering is being misunderstood, right? And so part of what
Exactly,
you are
exactly.
helping us to dismantle is that we don't have to suffer. We very much can achieve the kind of world we want to live in. And that starts with inclusion of people with disabilities and extends to inclusion of everyone. So at the end of the day,
Exactly.
what's good for autistic people is good for everyone. And that means all of us have a seat at the table
Hear,
when
hear.
it
Thank you.
comes
Hear, hear.
to,
Well
making
said.
it a better place. Yeah, my
Well,
pleasure.
well
Thank you
said.
so much.
So, for our listening audience, another great show of Health Chatter in the books here. And thank you, Ellie, for being with us. We got great shows coming up. We're doing a show coming up on the new blood pressure guidelines, which seem to come out every few years. And so we're hopefully going to address that and the possible confusion. We're going to be doing a show on menopause, pet health, and in January, we're going to be doing a show on yoga, actually with my yoga instructor, who's really, really good. He knows his stuff. And so these are shows coming down the pike. So for all of you out there, keep health chatting away.